Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The group that's supposed to find the next dangerous bubble in the American economy had its first meeting today. The heavy hitters were there, Geithner and Bernanke. But about that bubble, what are they going to do when they find it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses and nonprofits make sense of social media. You can learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Friday, everybody. It's the 1st of October today, and the group in question is called the Financial Stability Oversight Council. The Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Bill set it up. Besides the Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Fed, the panel has a bunch of other high-level regulators on it. They are stuck with the unenviable task of trying to find the next monster under our economic bed. There are some political turf wars brewing, but even if they can all get their acts together, how much can this council really do? Because our track record on popping bubbles painlessly just isn't so good. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
First, they can make public statements. Former Fed Governor Randall Krosner teaches economics at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business.
What is sometimes called open-mouth operations can be effective. They provide a warning that the supervisor sees some potential risks here, and that causes the private market actors to reassess those risks.
Second, they can change the rules. These are the top financial regulators. For example, if the housing market somehow heats up dangerously again, Krosner says the council could raise the required down payment on homes. The trick may be recognizing the bubble in the first place and having the guts to speak up. Cornelius Hurley directs the banking law program at Boston University. He says in a group of 10 voting members, it may be too easy to hide.
That's been the criticism of the council all along, is it diffuses responsibility too widely, and at the end of the day, no one person is responsible.
In the late 90s, a regulator named Brooksley Bourne sounded the alarm about derivatives. Those complex financial instruments helped fuel the recent crisis. Hurley says Bourne was shouted down by other regulators.
So we have to find in our system a place for the Brooksley Bournes of the world going forward.
Whether this council will be that place is unclear. Hurley says regulators are a lot more humble than they were before the crisis, or should be. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You remember back in May when the Dow fell 1,000 points in something like 5 minutes and then bounced right back? Today, two government agencies said that momentary panic, the flash crash as it's known, was caused by a single trading house that sold a bunch of stuff really fast. That triggered a whole lot of automatic selling and what are called high-frequency trades, when computers use split-second changes in prices to make money. Interestingly enough, just as that report started to leak this morning, we learned there's going to be a new cable laid across the Atlantic Ocean to be used by, wait for it, high-frequency traders. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has the story from New York.
It was 152 years ago when the first cable was laid underneath the Atlantic. There were fireworks in New York City. 60 million people in the U.S. and England could finally telegraph each other. Well, now the company Hibernia is laying another cable, so trading computers can talk to each other just a bit faster. Joe Hilt is vice president of sales for the company.
Currently today, the fastest cable across the Atlantic is about 65 milliseconds. This cable system will be sub-60 milliseconds. We believe that this is the fastest path between New Jersey and London.
It'll go to New Jersey because that's one of the big high-speed trading data centers. You need room for all those computers. Hilt says the company is laying the cable because traders need every fraction of a second they can get.
You know, it's really who gets there first. You know, so if people are trading off algorithms and they have a server and they're all in the same locations and somebody is traveling faster, you know, they may get in $55 a share rather than $55.50 a share.
That kind of difference matters when you're buying in bulk. Vasant Dhar is a professor of information systems at NYU's business school. He's not worried about the trend toward high speed. He says all that computer trading fills up the markets with money. It adds liquidity. But
the danger, which is when these guys just step away, as probably happened during the flash crash, you know, suddenly that all of that liquidity that was there dries up.
And unfortunately, even laying the cable underneath the ocean won't solve that kind of liquidity crisis. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, October got started on the right foot. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Now it's time for today's installment of Government Statistics, intended to explain why the economy is or is not where we would like it to be. Consumer spending is the number du jour. According to the Commerce Department, we spent a teeny bit more in August than we did a month earlier, 0.4% more to be exact. That was a teeny bit better than analysts expected, and it is a teeny bit of good news for retailers. They've been stuck the past couple of years in a discounting frenzy that's made it impossible to sell anything without practically giving it away. But today's numbers might finally give them a little pricing wiggle room, as Janet Babin reports.
Walmart was one of the first to raise prices on certain products back in August. Now, small pockets of stores are daring to follow suit. Analyst John Morris at BMO Capital Markets has seen a few specialty retailers try price increases on for size.
We've seen some strength in certain kinds of items and fashion, such as a military jacket at one retailer, such as really on-the-mark, on-trend styling of sweaters at another retailer.
Some stores will probably try to bump up prices just a notch, even if most shoppers don't bite. Professor John Quelch at Harvard Business School says retailers know that some of us out there won't notice the higher price tag.
At least if you have set the list price high, you're in a position to perhaps sell some of the merchandise at that higher price. And I think that's what the retailer is looking to do this season.
Other retailers would like to raise prices, but they can't. Many consumers are addicted to deep discounts. Ellen Davis is with the National Retail Federation.
We're not seeing consumers go to the stores and just decide to buy a flat-screen TV or a GPS like they may have in 2005 or 2006.
Stores that do raise prices may be able to attract value-conscious consumers when they slash prices. The higher the list price, the deeper that discount appears. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
We had it all this week in business and economic news. Talk of a currency war with China, the chance that taxpayers might get some of their AIG bailout money back, problems with foreclosures and credit unions. But today, our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond is going to start right with Wall Street. We're joined for that by our Friday regulars, Lee Gallagher. She's from Fortune Magazine. Also, John Carney. He's from CNBC. John, Lee, good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
So we had this report earlier today on the flash crash, which said, in essence, it was a glitch, right? I mean, there was this little computer thing. It happened, and then the markets went all kerflooey. Lee, do you feel any better now that you know that?
Absolutely not. I mean, it basically tells us, yes, this happened. It was a lot of trading that caused something really bad to happen. And guess what? You know, there's just no suggestion for policy changes or regulatory framework that could stop this from happening again, which basically means it could happen tomorrow.
John?
Well, not tomorrow. It could happen Monday.
All right, Monday. Yeah. John, you buy that?
I do think there's very little we found out that's reassuring. I mean, here we have the market going kablooey because somebody had placed a large order and we had a glitch. If you could do this by accident, can you imagine what somebody with more nefarious intentions might be able to do? That's not very reassuring.
So, John, riddle me this. What do we do to make the market safer, right? Fix the market infrastructure.
That's a very good question, and I'm not sure I have the answer for it. I think perhaps we might want to rethink some of the changes we made to the system over the last decade or so. We moved away from a system that had naturally evolved in the markets to a much more electronically driven, fractured system. This wasn't a natural outcome of a market process. It was driven largely by regulations. And we might want to rethink messing about with the basic market processes as they exist.
So, Lee, lay me the odds that that'll ever happen, that we're ever going to go back to something that's not electronic, right?
No, I mean, we've said goodbye to that. I mean, the market has changed so dramatically, as John said, but, you know, the regulators just haven't kept up with the technology at all. I mean, just look how hard it was to pass general financial reform. We're talking about technical reform of high-frequency electronic trading. I mean, that's a really long way from coming.
Okay, so a word before we go now about what is soon to be the dearly departed TARP. It expires on Sunday. I want Lee... A one-sentence answer to this question. Did it do what it was supposed to do?
Of course it did what it was supposed to do. Not only did
one sentence.
That's still one sentence.
Oh, wait, there was a comma in there that I missed somehow?
Commas are allowed.
All right.
It did what it was supposed to do. We were on the brink. It prevented things from going over the edge. We spent a little more than half of the $700 billion. We've made money on a big chunk of it, and I just don't understand why this is such a political hot potato.
Well, so that's the pivot to John Carney. Why do so many people hate this thing now when, objectively, it did at least most of what it was supposed to do?
It didn't do two of the major things it was supposed to do.
Uh-huh,
and
okay.
I think that's why people are upset. It was supposed to restart bank lending. And it's still very hard for many businesses or home buyers to get financing. Two, the major accomplishment that it supposedly had was that it kept us from going over the edge. Well, that's a counterfactual assertion. We don't know that we would have gone over the edge. The most absurd argument for the TARP worked that I've read has been Fareed Zakaria, who said, "The fact that there are so many people who now say maybe we didn't need the TARP is evidence that it worked."
See, I agree with that.
See, that's absurd. I think the economy may very well have been able to survive letting bad firms go under and letting good firms rise up. Instead, we're back in this situation where we'll never know.
I'm trying to get a word in here on my own program. But are you willing to take that chance?
Yes. I think we should have not taken a chance, but allowed the market to operate. And I think we would have done very well. I don't think we were quite in the dire straits that some of our policy leaders believed and that obviously the heads of banks that were in trouble believed.
You, sir, are a manlier man than I. John Carney from CNBC, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Guy.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Coming up, just because Facebook isn't powerful enough already, how that little like button is changing advertising as we know it.
If I see seven of my friends all like one restaurant, then I'm going to go there.
But first, let's do the numbers. New month, new quarter, modest gains. Concerns about slowing manufacturing growth drain some investors' enthusiasm from earlier in the day. Dow Industrials added 41 points this Friday, 0.4%, closed at 10,829. The NASDAQ ticked up 2 points, nearly a 0.1%, finished at 2370. The S&P 500 rose 5 points, 0.4%, ended things at 1146. The week was a modest downer. The Dow Industrials slipped 0.3%. The NASDAQ surrendered 0.4%. The S&P 500 ended down 0.2%. Financial shares surged fresh off the Treasury sale of shares in its bank. Citigroup deposited 4.6%. Goldman Sachs rose 2.1%, followed by JPMorgan Chase's gain of almost 2%. Bonds fell slightly. The yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at 2.51%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. By the Wall Street Journal Weekend, offering four sections of ideas and information, available at newsstands every Saturday. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents, information available at progressive.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for August. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly pending home sales index. And who knew it happened every year? It's the 10th anniversary Future of Music Policy Summit, and it's happening at Georgetown University. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. As we sit here in late 2010, post-Great Recession America, retirement in this country just doesn't mean what it used to. Older baby boomers have collectively lost $1 trillion from their 401ks the past couple of years. For most of us, the phrase retirement security is a non sequitur. So a couple of weeks ago, Tess Vigeland and I, she's the host of our personal finance program, Marketplace Money, we went to New York to talk to the guy who runs one of the biggest private retirement systems in the country.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Roger Ferguson, the CEO of TIAA Cref. It was a lovely day in Manhattan the day we were there, so we went up to the terrace on the roof to talk. As we sit here on this terrace, surrounded by the buildings of J.P. Morgan and Citibank and the rest of the financial sector, where's the culpability for what happened to people's retirement accounts? Is it in these buildings around us? Is it with us?
I subscribe to a general view that nothing this complex happens because there is one guilty party. The U.S. is not a savings economy. That's one of the things that happened. Secondly, there are some big swings in the way people work. That led us to move away from defined benefit plans to 401k plans. There was, I think, a lack of good advice and information and education for many people. So anything this complex, Kai, I think has many, many points of failure, some in the financial services sector, some with individuals, and frankly, some that were just fundamental big shifts in the way America works and does business that are no one's fault in particular.
One of the questions that we're getting a lot these days is, what should I be doing about the stock market? People are very skittish. There's a lot of trust issues. What's your advice in terms of how much to be in that risky pool?
I think the reality is that everybody has to be in that risky pool to some extent. The stock market over time has had a better return than fixed income. I emphasize over time because there's quite a bit of volatility in that market for sure. The challenge for them is the amount of exposure depends very much on one's risk appetite.
But determining your risk appetite is really difficult, especially after the last 2 years.
Yeah, it's just a scary proposition.
Absolutely, it's absolutely a scary proposition. One won't deny that. But to say I'm never going to be exposed to the stock market again, I think that is an imprudent form of being conservative.
I know that the company has been holding a contest to get folks to give you some ideas to get the national savings rate to 10%, I believe it
is. That's
correct. Can you share some of the answers with us so far?
It's called Raise the Rate. You can find it on the TIAA Cref website. And indeed, we've had a range of ideas. Most of them have been what I describe as micro. So, frankly, people are saying, I'm going to give up a cup of coffee every week. I won't mention the brand name, but you can all guess which one.
They're everywhere, and they cost $4, and yeah.
Exactly right. So that's the kind of thing we've seen, a number of ideas that are really very much focused in on what I, as an individual, can do to save an extra $5 to $10 a week that then mounts up over time.
So let's ask the macro question then. You are a trained economist. How do we increase the national savings rate? And you don't get the prize if you win your company's contest, by the way.
No, I do not get the prize.
All right.
Increase the national savings rate, I think, has a much bigger challenge, if you will. But not to take away from these small ideas. So if everyone did some of that, that would certainly help. We also clearly are going to have to change our mindset. We are a society of consumers. So part of this is going to be a big shift towards putting aside more money for savings and just thinking about it more broadly in those terms.
Well, and then, of course, you do have the people who say, look, you tell me I'm supposed to save, but then you tell me if I don't spend my money that the economy is going to get worse and worse and worse.
Look, we're talking here at a very unusual time, which is the turnaround from this very, very deep recession. And so both things are true. In order to keep the economy going, people are going to have to continue to spend appropriately. What we've been talking about, though, is a longer-term perspective, right? So as the economy heals, we are going to have an American economy that is more balanced away from consumption and more towards savings and investment.
On that point, though, you are a member of the President's Economic Recovery Advisory Board. I'm wondering if you'd share with us how those meetings are going, because it's you know, tricky.
Well, there's no question that it's tricky. We give the president a range of different advice. For example, one of the groups that I was on just came out with a report on simplifying, streamlining the tax system. We had some early discussion around an infrastructure bank, and that played into one of the president's recent initiatives. The sad truth is there is no easy fix for the current relatively gradual turnaround. There's not going to be a silver bullet that's suddenly going to get us back to maximum employment in the U.S. for some time to come.
So this is a little bit off topic, but have you ever called the marketing guys in and said, listen, this whole TIA CREF thing, you're killing us in branding and marketing? I mean, come on.
This company has been around for 92 years. We are very importantly thinking about how to make sure people understand what that mouthful of letters stands for. And what it stands for is working with people to get them safely to and through retirement. So that's our brand.
Yeah, maybe you're thinking about it?
Maybe I'm thinking about reinforcing the brand image for sure. There's no question of that.
Roger Ferguson, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We talk longer than that, of course. Our entire conversation with Roger Ferguson is on our website. It's marketplace.org. And there is more on Marketplace Money this weekend with Tess as well. The movie to see this weekend, by all the reviews that I've read anyway, is The Social Network. It's the one about how Facebook got started and turned into the be-all and end-all of social networking that we now know today. Even if you don't have a Facebook account yourself, though, it's pretty hard to miss. You go to almost any corporate website today, newspapers to consumer products to food, and you'll notice the Facebook Like button. It's about the size of a Tic Tac. It's got a little picture of a thumbs up on it. And Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports consumers and companies seem to be liking it.
See a cute picture of your friend's labradoodle? You like it. Read a great article about Fashion Week in the New York Times? You like it. A cool new tequila bar? Wall Street 2? The striped grandpa cardigan at Urban Outfitters? Since it was launched 5 months ago, nearly 2 million websites, from the New York Times to Pepsi to Yelp, have added the Facebook Like button to their web pages. And it's not just about ego.
You like me right now. You like me.
When you click on the little thumbs up icon, you hand over your Facebook data to the company, and it gets access to your friends' data, too. James Fowler is the co-author of Connected, The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks.
All of a sudden, they're tapped into this vast resource that is going to help them to have a much finer picture of each one of their consumers.
So that company you like suddenly knows where you live, where you went on vacation, your favorite bands, your friends' favorite bands, just about everything on your Facebook page. And the Like button boils all of that down for companies. Fowler says that's what companies really like about the Like button.
It used to be that the problem was we didn't have enough information. And now I think increasingly the problem is that we don't have enough tools to sift through all these mountains of data that we're collecting online. Essentially, what the Like button is it's a one-question questionnaire.
In other words, pushing the Like button is like sending up a flare, telling the company, I like your products. Offer me a deal. Andreas Weigand teaches social networking and data mining at Stanford.
If you actually really deeply think about it, it is that you are doing the broadcasting and they are tuning in. I think it will change the behavior of the next billion people.
Vigen says the Facebook like button is turning our relationship with business on its head. We are suddenly marketing products for companies, flagging ourselves as people they should sell things to, endorsing the product to our friends, and handing the company our friends' information.
We definitely have seen a huge excitement and engagement around the like button.
Megan O'Connor heads up social marketing for Levi's, one of the earliest like button adopters. She says the simplicity of the like button is key. In the last 6 months, about 1 million people have said they like Levi's.
You know, we have ratings and reviews on our site, which takes a little bit longer for somebody to engage with. And this is really a really light touch way that people can engage with our products and really share that engagement with their friends.
So you can like the Jaded Rinse Boyfriend Jean or the Crybaby Skinny Jeans and set up a friend store with your Facebook pals so you can see what they like and they can see what you like and Levi's can see what everybody likes. Connected author James Fowler says the like button is letting retailers tap into the all-powerful friends network for the first time.
We tend to choose friends who are like us. Sociologists call this homophily. It's a word that literally means love of like. Birds of a feather flock together. Because we tend to choose these people who are like us, knowing what they like helps us to know what we like.
And we like to know what we like, says Matt Britton, CEO of social marketing firm Mr. Youth. He says we trust information from our friends.
So say I'm searching for an Italian restaurant in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And if I see seven of my friends all like one restaurant, then I'm going to go there. And I don't care what else is on a search engine.
Britton says Google does not like this. Because Google has focused on bringing us the most popular results for our searches. But Facebook could show us what is most popular among our friends, what they thought of the movie you're buying a ticket for, or the brand of paint you're thinking about using in the nursery.
And in a lot of ways, your social network soon is going to be the web. The web is your social network, where every website you're on and every web browser experience will be in some way socially enabled.
Britton says Facebook is hoping its like button will just be the beginning. And eventually, everything we search for, read about, and shop for will be filtered through our network of Facebook friends. In other words, Facebook's little button is, like, huge. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com. And by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals on the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today toward a more consumer-friendly Internal Revenue Service, perhaps. The left-leaning think tank Third Way has a new policy paper out. It says we ought to get a receipt from the government when we pay our taxes. If you go to the store, you get an itemized receipt for your eggs and your toilet paper and whatnot, right? Third Way has mocked up the receipt for a person making about $35,000 a year. Here are some of the specifics. $229 to pay for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. $1,040 for Social Security. Almost $64 for federal highways. There's a link to it on our website if you want to see it for yourself. It's pretty interesting stuff. Marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace, the radio show from American Public Media this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow up 41 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ ticked up 2 points, nearly 0.1%. The S&P 500 rose 5 points, about 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Weston. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. This weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, dealing with the rising cost of college by not saving for it.
We got these kids who have a good sense of the world. We invested in children, not in retirement accounts and college accounts.
I like that. Interesting. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.